Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Tom and Jackie Hawks love their life in retirement, sailing on their yacht, the well-deserved. But when the birth of a new grandson called them back to Arizona, they put the boat up for sale. Skylar DeLeon and his pregnant wife Jennifer showed up as prospective buyers, with their baby in a stroller, and the Hawkses thought they had a deal. Soon after a sea trial and an alleged purchase, however, the older couple disappeared, and the DeLeons promptly tried to access the Hawkses' bank accounts. As police investigated the case, they not only found a third homicide victim with ties to Skylar, they also uncovered an unexpected and unusual motive. Skylar had wanted gender reassignment surgery for years. By killing the Hawkses with a motley crew of assailants and plundering the couple's assets, the DeLeons had planned to clear their $100,000 in debts and still have money for the surgery, which Skylar had already scheduled. Now in this up-to-the-minute updated edition, which includes extensive new material, New York Times bestselling author Caitlin Rother presents the latest breaking developments in the case. Skylar, who was ultimately sentenced to death row for the three murders, transitioned to a woman via hormones while living in the psych unit at San Quentin Prison. Recently, she legally changed her name and gender to female, apparently a strategic step in her quest to obtain taxpayer-subsidized gender confirmation surgery and transfer to a woman's prison. Combined with Governor Gavin Newsom's recent moratorium on executions, this only adds insult to injury for the victims' families, who want Skylar to receive the ultimate punishment for her crimes. The book that we're featuring this evening is Dead Reckoning, extensively revised and updated edition, with my special guest, journalist and author, Caitlin Rother. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Caitlin Rother.
Hi.
Good evening. Thank you very much for joining us to talk about this newly updated and revised version of Dead Reckoning.
Uh-huh. Happy to be here.
Now, Caitlin, tell us what this revision and update includes. We're not going to go back into, for people are very familiar with this story from a past interview about Dead Reckoning, so let's concentrate on the revised and updated version of this. And
uh-huh.
What news do you have brought to this incredible story? You talked about you had been in touch with Skylar and watched her appearance and psychological state evolve. Tell us about the interviews that you did before he was sentenced, and then this quest to interview him again after he was on death row in San Quentin.
Okay, just in case there's anybody who doesn't know about this case, I'm just going to give just a few sentences just so people understand what the basic case is. And that is Tom and Jackie Hawks, who are retirees originally from Prescott, Arizona, bought a boat called the Well Deserved. They sailed around Mexico for a couple of years. One of Tom's sons had a grandbaby. That was Tom's grandbaby, and they wanted to come back to Arizona to be with their grandson. So Tom put the boat up for sale. He advertised it with a broker and also without a broker because he was trying to save himself commission. And Skylar DeLeon, who at the time was presenting as a man, and this is why this is a tricky story to kind of talk about back and forth in time, because Skylar is one of the reasons for the update is Skylar has now legally changed her name and gender to female, but at the time of the murder, right. Skylar was presenting as a man, but the motive for the murder was to get money for gender confirmation surgery. So it's kind of a, I just wanted to give kind of some update. But anyway, Skylar right. brings Jennifer, his wife, who's pregnant with their second child, with the, their 10-month-old daughter out to the boat to meet Tom and Jackie to gain their trust. And then Skylar comes back another few times, once with a 19-year-old guy he met in jail, who was actually one of the guards there, who he made friends with. And then he brought also an older, bigger guy, muscular muscle guy named John F. Kennedy, and he was what we call a shot caller in the gang culture from the Long Beach insane Crips. So he supposedly had turned his life over and was about to become a minister, meets Skylar, and within 20 minutes has already agreed to go onto this boat and help Skylar commit these murders. So that's, you know, hypocritical story. I also, though, think that Skylar probably may not have told him exactly what they were going to be doing, but did promise him, you know, like $1 million. These people are rich. They've got this yacht. So anyway, Skylar and Alonzo McChain, who is the young former jail guard, and this guy who I'll call JFK, three of them come on there. They overtake Tom and Jackie with tasers and handcuffs and force them to sign power of attorney documents and promise that they'll, you know, save their lives as long as they sign these documents. But then instead they take them back on the deck. They're blindfolded. They're gagged. And Tom tries to fight back, and Skylar just laughs it off. They basically tape them together with Jackie's back to Tom's chest, put the tape around them, and then tie them to the anchor, throw the anchor overboard, and they are basically pulled down to the depths of the ocean and drowned alive. So this is this horrible, horrible murder. And in the course of investigating this murder, detectives also find that Skylar killed another guy who he also met in jail, who was in for counterfeiting, and he was a drug addict named John Jarvie. He took him down to Mexico with some other ploy, took $50,000 from him and said apparently that they were going to go buy drugs and probably make a bunch of money. And instead, Skylar cut his throat and left him to die at the side of a road in Mexico, and was actually in jail at the time, went back to jail because he was supposed to be out on work furlough, signed in with Alonzo McChain still in charge at the jail, and got there 2 hours late, but nobody said anything, and proceeded to use the jail computer to buy an anal sex machine that evening with his credit card. So this is incredible. This is just a quick synopsis of the murder. Anyway, so here we are all these years later. The lead detective on the case, David Byington, told me that as far as he was concerned, the primary motivation for this murder was, you know, Skylar and Jennifer were $100,000 in debt. But more importantly for Skylar, Skylar wanted a sex change operation, which is what they called it back then, and now they call it a gender confirmation surgery. But in court, the prosecutor chose to just go with a greed motive because, in my opinion, that's just an easier, less complicated argument to make for a jury in what was at that time more conservative kind of a county, law enforcement kind of county. So all these years later, Jennifer was convicted for life without the possibility of parole. Skylar tried to cut off his penis in jail, and they wouldn't give him hormones, so he was trying to transition in jail, wasn't allowed, got to death row at San Quentin, and that's where he went finally got hormones and transitioned to a female, and now has done it legally. So to answer your question, when I went to go visit Skylar in the county jail, Skylar was still presenting as a man. So if I go back and forth between he and she, it's because it's kind of hard to keep it straight sometimes. But from a journalistic standpoint and out of respect to the LGBTQ community, you know, especially now that Skylar is a woman, you know, you're supposed to refer to someone who wants to be a woman to as a she. So it's complicated,
Certainly.
And I'm not trying to offend anybody, because there are other people, a whole other group of people who feel that inmates don't deserve any rights at all, and especially someone like Skylar, who actually committed murder to gain a gender reassignment surgery, should not be given the respect to be given the female pronoun. So this is the balance I have to walk when I do these interviews, and it's a long preface, but I just wanted to make all that clear. So to ask me what you'd like to know about the first set of interviews.
When you went and first interviewed him, you talked about how he was presenting, and you can tell
That's
us about that.
For looking like a man, but mm-hmm. the whole four interviews, and most of what we talked about was how Skylar did not want her penis attached because it didn't feel like it belonged there. So clearly, Skylar wanted to look like a woman and felt like a woman inside, and said that repeatedly to me.
When you went to San Quentin, in those interviews, what did you try to get? What kind of information did you try to get from him? What did he want to concentrate on in terms of information?
Well, I have to make another preface here. I'm allowed to talk about what we talked about at the Santa Ana jail, but even though Skylar invited me to come and visit her at San Quentin, and I interviewed her for 2.5 hours, I got a nasty, threatening letter from her attorney saying, "You're not allowed to use anything that Skylar said to you at San Quentin, because Skylar is not mentally competent to consent to give an interview," which is part of the story, honestly. So it's an important mm-hmm. part of the story, and I can talk about the legal aspects of this, and I can talk about what I saw. I can talk about my observations, but I'm not legally allowed to discuss what she said to me, which is a little frustrating. But to be honest, a lot of it was stuff that she already said to me when we were sitting in the county jail. And I was able to reproduce, you know, the entire scene because I got a lot of the same information from third parties. So I had sources at San Quentin who were correctional officers who actually were in the psych unit with Skylar and could, you know, basically, you know, reconfirm many of the things that she told me. So I just want to make that clear that I am not violating any kind of legal barriers here, that I am doing this. Working around that. But the fact of the matter is that Skylar wanted to look and felt like a woman inside, and that the penis was not, she didn't even want to say the word penis. That was how distasteful it was to her. Like, she would not use that word.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
so,
ask her about, sorry.
Go ahead.
You ask her about her psychiatric diagnosis by doctors and also the medication that she was on. So, tell
I
us
did
about that.
I did that in the county jail, and I also did
yes.
that when I was at San Quentin. But again, in San Quentin, I'm not allowed to tell you what she told me, so it's a little tricky. But what was already in the first edition of the book pretty much still stands. But Skylar, you know, Skylar is a liar. So some of what she said checked out, and some of it, you know, didn't. For example, and I don't have the book in front of me for all the specific diagnoses, but, you know, severe gender dysphoria. That is the diagnosis for people who are born one gender and feel differently on the inside than they look physically on the outside. So that matches. There were a number of – do you have those in front of you? You usually do. I know you're really good at this. I don't
mm-hmm.
have them all memorized. But
well,
anyway,
it had,
she
– yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
I honestly didn't review all those right before I called, but I'm just doing them from memory. I know she had epilepsy when she was growing up.
Yes.
And I asked her something about, you know, sociopathy, and she said, "Oh, I asked them about that, and they said that's not true." Well, that's a generic term for somebody who doesn't seem to know the difference between right and wrong, or if they do, they ignore it and do it anyway. But to me, Skylar always seemed as though she just basically wanted to know whatever I wanted her to say. So, and I know this is pretty much how she must have operated with everybody else, and that is, and that's pretty similar with con men and con women. They're very manipulative. They try to read whoever they're talking to tell them whatever they want to hear. And, you know, I think you and I talked about that with Charles Manson, the book that I did that came out last year, Hunting Charles Manson.
Sure.
Same thing. That's what these people do. They lock on to you. They look you in your eyes, and they test out. They say things, and they test you out and see what you respond to. And I could see Skylar doing that with me, where I would try to ask her a question, and she looked at me to try to see what I wanted her to say and try to tell me what I wanted to hear, which is not what I want to hear. I want to hear the truth, right? But with somebody like this, it's very difficult. So the most truthful thing, honestly, that we could talk about was her gender dysphoria. But I could tell you from my observations at San Quentin, she seemed happy. She seemed relaxed. She was on medication that she had not been on previously. She seemed more rational and more lucid and, frankly, just happier in her own skin than she ever had. All the times I'd seen her in court, the four times I visited her in the county jail, she was finally not having to pretend to be, you know, a man, number one, or a provider or a father or any of those things. And, you know, I think she liked the attention, too, obviously, of me being there and talking to her. But then, you know, she also has lawyers who, you know, shut all that down. As soon as I got home, I had this letter waiting for me saying, you know, you can't use anything she said because she's not mentally competent. And he wouldn't talk to me. The lawyer wouldn't talk to me about this. But it's pretty complicated, and you can't have it both ways. So if she wants to get taxpayer-subsidized gender confirmation surgery, which is now possible in California for inmates in California prisons, much to the dismay of pretty much everyone I talk to, taxpayers and the victims' families alike, you have to be mentally competent and able to make a medical decision. So I don't know how that's going to play if she is, in fact, applying for this surgery, which she's wanted her whole life and, in fact, wanted so badly that she killed the Hawks for it. If she's not mentally competent, then she's not going to be able to get that surgery. And second of all, one of the other criteria that the state uses to decide who gets this surgery, and they've only, I think they've only approved something like 10 requests, and these numbers keep changing and growing, but they keep recategorizing gender and the way people identify. So there are all these different terms being used now, and they change all the time, and so I can't keep up with them. But, you know, there's non-binary, there's, you know, all kinds of stuff where people want to be called they instead of he or she, and
sure.
And so the prison system is now having to figure out where to house these people, because the straight men and the straight women don't want these people living with them, because they feel, whether they're right or not, I think that in at least the women, they say, well, these people were born as men and, you know, they could be more violent and hurt us and we don't want them. We don't feel safe. And the men sexually assault the transgender females who were, you know, in the men's prison with them. So it's actually quite a quandary for the prison system on trying to figure out where to put these people. And once somebody in Skylar's situation who has now gone to court and gotten a judge to sign a petition that says Skylar's middle name is now Preciosa, which means gem. It was previously, Skylar was born John Julius Jacobson and changed her name to Skylar Julius Jacobson. And now it's Skylar Preciosa de Leon. I'm sorry, Skylar de Leon, and then Skylar Preciosa de Leon. And she picked Skylar, I think, because it was kind of one of those names that could be male or female.
Right.
And now she has legally become a woman, she can ask to be transferred to a women's prison because that was what she wanted to do way back since she was in the county jail. That was one of the things we talked about. And at the time, they housed people according to their genitalia. So as long as you still had a penis, regardless of whether you said you were a transgender female or not, if you still had a penis, you were still housed with the men. Now, today that's
right.
changed because of the court precedents and cultural changes, that now if you ask to be transferred to, it's how you identify. So
mm-hmm.
if you identify as a woman but you still have a penis, they have to take your petition seriously, and if you've gone to court, presumably, they have to take it even more seriously. So she's either getting pretty good legal advice to get what she wants, and she's, you know, using the system to her advantage. I keep watching, you know, the inmate locator computer system to see if she's been moved or not, but, you know, San Quentin has its own psych unit, and she's been in and out of there since it opened, which was in 2014. And before that, there's a state prison facility at Vacaville, which you might have heard of, and she was back and forth
yeah.
between
yeah.
Vacaville and San Quentin repeatedly. One other thing I can talk about was when I was sitting in the cage with her at San Quentin, and this was pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
I came to visit her, and they said, okay, give us the paper that you brought and the pen, which was supposed to be pre-approved. They took away my paper and my pen, and they gave me a notepad that was theirs. Because, you know, I'm probably going to smuggle in something, right? Like, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
And so I sat there, and they go sit in that cage over there. So I'm sitting in this cage, and then they walk Skylar in, who now looks like a woman with a side ponytail and breasts and the whole thing, and they lock her in there with me. I'm like, oh, my
yeah.
God.
Wow.
And she puts her hands through the hole in the door, and they take her cuffs off. So I'm sitting in there locked inside a cage with someone who's killed three people, you know, and had
yeah.
and showed no remorse about it whatsoever. And I'm sitting there with a pen, and I'm sitting there with a spork, you know, a plastic combination fork spoon.
Right.
Because part of the deal when you go and visit an inmate, you buy them lunch if you're going at lunchtime because you're basically, they don't get to eat otherwise. And it's just a
right.
nice thing to do so that, you know, the person will talk to you if you're someone in my situation. So I bought her a quesadilla, chicken quesadilla with a couple avocados, which is what she wanted, and gave her the spork, right? I purposely did not hand her a plastic knife. And then And then she wanted to draw me something with the pen, and I just thought to myself, that thing's could possibly end up in my neck. And I, you know, and by the time the guard gets over there, who knows, you know, what would happen. Anyway, but again, you know, that didn't happen because she got to talk about what she wanted to talk about, and I didn't upset her or say anything to confront her or anything. So, but my point is, you know, she wants to be housed with the women. And it looks now that she's taken legal steps to further that. And I am presuming that she's applied. I'm not allowed to get that information legally because of privacy laws and HIPAA laws. But she told me always that she wanted that operation, and she was even trying to get private money to pay for it. So that's the deal. She's still trying to get what she wants, and there's no end in sight for her or anyone who's on death row in terms of executions, because the governor, Gavin Newsom, basically put a moratorium on executions, which looked like it was going to end because we had a lethal injection protocol that was under review. That was a new one because the last one was deemed unconstitutional and deemed that the chemical they used was too painful and was like torture, and that's a violation of the Constitution. So they were looking for a one-drug cocktail. It's not really a cocktail if it's just one drug. But anyway, a new protocol using just one drug.
Mm-hmm.
And Gavin Newsom basically stopped that whole process. He basically took apart the whole new chamber that the previous governor, a couple of governors back, Arnold Schwarzenegger, had built to start up executions again. He dismantled that. And he basically said there will be no executions for as long as I'm governor. So that could be, you know, another few years. It could be another 7 years.
Yeah.
So there's really no end in sight for anybody on death row. There's more than 700 people on death row in California, and that makes people mad. That makes people mad who think that Skylar should not be able to get what she wants after killing people, you know?
How did California, and because you write in this book about how California got to this, where other states haven't even considered this, so you talk about a case that started from a lawsuit in 2015 that started this whole ball rolling.
It actually started in Massachusetts. There was an inmate in Massachusetts, Michelle Kosilek, I believe she was Philip before that, or Robert, I can't remember. Anyway, Michelle Kosilek, another person, another killer. And this is what's curious to me. The person in Massachusetts who was the one that started this ball rolling, and the case actually, you know, she had a trial, blah, blah, blah. She was supposed to get the surgery. It got overturned. They sent it up to the Supreme Court. They didn't want to hear it. So she was kind of stuck. Got back to the case you're referring to, Norsworthy, here in California. Again, a federal judge here granted the surgery, and rather than appeal it and go through all that nonsense, the parole board basically granted her parole rather than having to open that Pandora's box.
Wow.
Because they said, well, she's up for parole. She's allowed to have parole, even though they had denied it, I think, six times previously. This time they just let her go, and that way they didn't have to deal with the controversy. But then there was another lawsuit that came before them, and the same federal judge said, hey, this person's going to get the surgery too, and this person wasn't eligible for parole. So the California system basically said, well, I guess we're going to need to act because we don't want to be told by the court on who gets the surgery and who doesn't. We want to come up with our own criteria and our own application process, and then we will determine who gets the surgery and not the court. And this also, along the way, there was, during the Obama administration, the Department of Justice got involved in a case in Atlanta where there was an inmate who had been taking hormones, another transgender female who had been taking hormones for 17 years, got to jail, and they just wouldn't give her hormones anymore because she still had a penis. And this is Georgia,
right. And
this is way more conservative down there. And so she basically started turning back into a man with a beard, and, you know, that was very distressing for her and upsetting for her, and, you know, filed the lawsuit and whatever. And the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, weighed in and said, look, the Constitution requires under the Eighth Amendment that you must provide, quote unquote, adequate medical care to inmates. And when someone has severe gender dysphoria, that is a medical condition as well as a mental condition, and you must treat it just like any other. And so, again, rather than deal with all that, they released her 3 years early. And so that's what kept happening. And it's come up in other states, and I think I mentioned also in the update, I think it was Iowa or Idaho, one of the I states, where they were about ready to have to deal with something too. So California has been in front of this, but only because I think of, you know, some of the judges here are probably more progressive. But, you know, I'm surprised actually. Well, I guess in Massachusetts it would have gone further, but the Supreme Court didn't want to hear it, and it didn't get to the Supreme Court. The California cases didn't get to the Supreme Court. And now if it got to the Supreme Court, I'm sure they would reject it. The new Supreme
Court. You talk about a correctional officer, you cite an example, $23,000, but that's not the entire cost, and you say that the state is now paying between $50,000 and $100,000 for this reassignment surgery.
Yeah, it's hard to estimate that. I had to use some kind of numbers. But so, okay, because you know how insurance works. You know, there's a cost, and then there's a cost that they assign it, which isn't a real cost, but it's what the hospital tries to charge, and then the insurance comes up with some number, and they say, all right, well, we'll pay this much, and then you have a deductible and blah, blah, blah. So she told me it was $23,000. I don't really know if that's the total cost, if that's the cost the hospital charged. But anyway, that's what she, as a private citizen, paid under her state-provided insurance now, so because she's a state employee, okay? So she's getting insurance through her government job as a correctional officer. So again, that may not be a real figure, but the reason that it's higher for the inmates to get surgery is because they've got to be guarded around the clock. They have these surgeries and procedures, and there's usually more than one, so it's more than just one snip-snip. You know, you've got to go in for some procedures, and then there may be multiple procedures. And then that you've got to be guarded by, I think, one or two correctional officers who sit outside your room, right, make sure you don't escape, and someone doesn't come in and try to free you or whatever. And, you know, same thing with Manson. I mean, he must have been an incredibly expensive patient, because every time he had an issue, he was bleeding inside. He had heart problems. He had emphysema. He had ended up with cancer, and he was bleeding, in, you know, down in his lower intestine, I believe, and, you know, had all kinds of things going on. And he was at the hospital for days at a time, and it must have cost them a fortune, you know, heart surgery and then cancer. And the state is required to provide that. So this counts. You know, in terms of, it is a medical, it is considered a medical condition that is required under the Constitution, under the Eighth Amendment.
Right. Now, you provide reactions. You talk to Dave Byington, retired Newport Beach Police Department, Gail O'Neill, Leanne McCullough. Tell us what Dave Byington had to say about the prospect that he would,
pretty much all came from the same place, and that was just outrage. David Byington was the lead detective sergeant on this case who helped put Jennifer Schuyler, JFK, in prison. And he knows. He's the one who told me from the very beginning that this was the motive for the murder, and he was, you know, really upset that, and upset for the families, too, who that's who the McCullough is, Tom's, Leanne McCullough is Tom Hawk's niece, so Tom's brother's daughter. She is a police officer. Her father is a retired police chief. Her husband's a police officer. So these are law enforcement people, and they just are, you know, and they're related to, you know, their loved one was murdered. So they don't want Schuyler to get what Schuyler wanted, which was the surgery. And they also, I mean, Leanne was mentioning, you know, she was concerned. She wrote a letter to Governor Newsom saying, look, this whole thing with the moratorium, and I can't remember if she wrote a separate, if she wrote a separate letter about the surgery thing, or if I just, I think I just did an interview because it was several years between those two things happening. But she sent me a copy of the letter. And so she basically just said to the governor, look, you know, it's not just me, but there are other victims' families who are just really concerned that you start doing things like this, and then these people are somehow going to be able to be released into the community. That's not happening. I mean, death row is death row. These just because these people aren't going to be executed doesn't mean they're also going to be released. They're not. They're just not going to be executed in the next 7 years, and it doesn't mean they won't ever be, but as long as he's governor. You know, she was just concerned, I guess, that this was going to lead to other moves that were maybe more lenient. But she, you know, definitely didn't want to see Schuyler play in the system. Jackie's mother, Gail O'Neill, she's a sweet woman. We've stayed in touch. She just doesn't know what to think, and she's just disgusted by all of it and just doesn't, you know, understand. She called the governor's office. She was so mad when she heard about the moratorium on the executions, because, you know, they were promised that, you know, they were going to get some kind of, they wanted the death penalty for Schuyler. So, and now it's not coming anytime soon. And I know Tom's son, Ryan Hawks, was also upset as well. So they're all very upset. And when I've talked to them about the surgery, they're upset about that too. They don't think that Schuyler should be able to get the surgery, and frankly, they don't think that they don't agree with the taxpayers paying for that at all for any inmate, frankly. But certainly not one who killed somebody in order to get the surgery.
Well, it's an interesting argument too when you say that someone's doing an 80-year sentence. They're not going to get out. They're convicted of an incredibly heinous murder or murders.
Right.
What is the use of even providing that necessary medical treatment when somebody asks, oh, how about the psychiatric or psychological treatment for the victim's families for life? I don't think that's provided.
Right. That's what Detective Byington said, exactly. That, you know, hey, if you're going to spend money on this kind of stuff, why don't you help the families deal with the trauma and being so upset about being basically re-injured every time you give something to these inmates? Well, the thing of it is, whether you agree with it or approve of it or not, inmates are people and inmates have rights. And even though a lot of people don't agree with that, that's the country we live in and that's the Constitution. And when Leanne was talking to me, she's like, what do I tell my kids? And I say, well, you're a law enforcement family. You explain to them this is what the Constitution requires, you know, because that's the simple answer. It's, regardless of whether you support it or not, you know, that's where we live and that's what kind of country we're supposed to be. And that's the basis for these decisions. The thing is, the Eighth Amendment is the one that says, you know, you're not allowed to inflict cruel and unusual punishment on an inmate. And so what that means is you have to treat their medical problems. And if you have somebody who's got severe gender dysphoria that is causing them so much distress that they are trying to kill themselves and are trying to mutilate themselves by trying to cut their penises off by any means possible, whether it's a razor blade that they shouldn't have or some kind of tool that they've stolen or found because they just really want to do this to themselves and, you know, are bleeding everywhere, you know, they have to take that seriously. They are required to.
Well, there already is a suicide watch and protocols for that, for somebody that would be bent on suicide.
Right, but this is mutilation with knives and razors and blood, which is different than Jeffrey Epstein, if you believe that he killed himself. I don't know, who knows what to believe.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you want to kill yourself, you can. They do provide razors because there are other reasons why they want inmates to, you know, be hygienic or whatever, especially if they deal with food and or if they work in a cafeteria or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think they have safety razors. They're made specifically, I think, for inmates. And so if somebody really wants to do that, they just have to kind of take this apart and, you know, try to figure out, attach it to a piece of paper or something. I think that's what Skylar said that she did at the jail. But she didn't my understanding was she didn't really do herself that much damage. But then I looked at her arms. Her arms had visible purple welts on them from where she cut herself. And I know that she cut herself from the correctional officers telling me. And I believe she used a plastic cup that, you know, was sharp. So that's not that sharp, that you're literally dragging a sharp plastic edge, which is not metal, which is not a knife, and so you're causing pretty bad scarring, and it was vertical. It was not horizontal, and vertical means you mean business. You know, if you're just slashing little ones across, that's generally a call for attention. If you're going vertical, that means you're really trying to kill yourself.
Right.
And those were the welts that I saw on her arms, from the scars of trying to do that. And I also understood from the correctional officer that Skylar would bang her head against the wall to make a huge bump, like a unicorn. Just to get attention.
I can see, Yeah, sure. But some people claim that all of it is to gain attention because it does afford him that attention.
Yeah, and I am not sympathizing with Skylar. I am just talking specifically generically about this condition, gender dysphoria, and I've been talking a lot about it. And, you know, I don't have a medical degree. I am not a psychologist, but I have written many books about a lot of mental health issues with these killers, and I've been covering mental illness in the California prison system for far longer than I've been an author. When I was a reporter at the San Diego Union-Tribune, I also covered this as part of my beat for many, many years, and California had lawsuits against it because they were not providing proper mental health care to the inmates, and they ended up having to have a federal agency basically set up as a monitor to come in and make sure that these inmates were getting proper care because they weren't. And so this is bigger than California. This goes
right
way back, and it's not just a transgender thing. This is a mental health is a mental health issue. And you know, our jails, even here in San Diego, there have been stories about how bad our county jails are. These inmates, even at the jail, the county level, the local level, are killing themselves at an alarming rate. And this is because we are not providing proper mental health care in our society in general. And so these people are ending up in the county jails and in the state prisons when they've got pretty severe mental health issues. And, you know, some of them commit crimes, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they've become our modern, you know, state institutions for the mentally ill. And
yes, certainly.
So, you know, you can say, well, people are playing the system. A lot of these people are pretty seriously mentally ill and have a lot of issues. And, you know, they self-medicate and they kill people, or they've just got these deep-seated genetic or environmental predispositions. They don't have any control over it, and they kill people. And there are some people who make choices. And so the question is, are these people evil, or are they mentally ill, or is it a little bit of both? And I'm not saying, you know, you can't say they're all the same because they're not. Each case is different. But with Skylar, there really wasn't a lot of attention paid. In fact, there was almost none paid to mental health issues in Skylar's case. And when I asked Skylar's trial attorney about that, you know, did you do a psychiatric examination? He said, yeah. And I go, well, how come you didn't bring that into court? And he said, well, I didn't think it would help our case. So
wow.
The thing of it is I've been covering this case longer than any other case in my entire career,
right,
which is
yeah
saying something. I mean, this case started, mm-hmm, the murders were in 2004. It's now 2019. And I've seen a lot of changes. You know, I've seen a lot of changes in Skylar. I've seen a lot of changes in the California system and how they deal with these issues. And I've seen a lot of changes in, like I said, in the jails and in the prisons, in terms of how many people who are mentally ill are ending up behind bars because they're not getting treatment in the community. John Gardner, who is in a state prison after raping and killing two teenage girls here in our county, San Diego, tried to get help and couldn't get help because he was a sex offender and they wouldn't let him into any of the substance abuse or mental health facilities because he was a sex offender. So that's a big,
right,
giant hole in the system too. So these people are out there committing crimes, and sometimes they know that there's something wrong and they try to get help and they can't. So
yes,
it's a complicated thing, and I know a lot of people want to just dismiss these people and say, lock them up, let's not think about it. Well, that's expensive. I mean, there's
yeah
a facility in California for violent sexual predators, and at the time when I wrote the book Lost Girls, I think it was like $187,000 a year to treat one inmate. So, I mean, even if you do take it seriously and you do lock them away and you do try to get them treatment and some people say you can't ever rehabilitate these people because it's just part of who they are. It costs a lot of money. So there's no really good answer here. Do you know what I mean?
Well, people think that possibly putting somebody to death would save some money. And as you know, especially, that doesn't save any money at all. And it's far more expensive. My question is,
it's far more expensive to house them in a secure environment like that. And so where are you in Canada?
I'm in Ontario.
In Ontario, because it's funny, you know, my mom and stepdad have a place on Salt Spring Island, and I did a couple of talks at the library there, and one of them was about Lost Girls, and it was about John Gardner and our system and the holes in it, and they could not understand how the California government was treating these mentally ill people, you know, even though they're criminals. It's funny to me that the people in Canada look at all of these issues that you and I are talking about today in a completely different light. than they do in the United States and in California in particular, with a much more compassionate kind of, you know, perspective.
I think they do, but there's issues there as well.
I'm sure.
What I was talking about was the prosecution. I find it odd, and maybe I can ask you, why you would think that prosecutors would still opt for the death penalty in cases where they know that likely, almost absolutely, these people won't be put to death. And with the incredible cost of the appeal process.
I know. Well, that's a very good point. And, you know, I usually try not to take a position on the death penalty. I try not to take a position on gun control. I try not to take a position on religion. I try not to take a position on presidential politics because they are such lightning rods, and I'll just lose readers. But I'll just tell you, I do believe that if people knew how much the death penalty system and death sentences and death penalty trials cost, compared to trials where you're just sending somebody for life without parole, and then how much it costs to house these people in single cells. And, you know, it takes it can take 5, 7, 8 years to get to trial. Just there's so many more I's and T's that they have to dot and cross with a death penalty case. They have to call more witnesses. They have to take a lot more steps to be more careful because they know their appeals, and it's just a much costlier system. And it really doesn't make sense to keep trying people for the death penalty if you're never going to execute them, because what's the point? But I guess there are families who still really want this, and as some of the prosecutors have said, and I think I quoted one in my update, as long as the law is still in place to keep trying people under the death penalty system, they're almost required to, because it's somewhat up to the DA, I guess, whether they pursue the death penalty or not. But as long as the law is still in place, that's still part of their job to try a case under the death penalty and give people death sentences. And it doesn't make sense. It's not – the system's broken, clearly.
Yeah.
And they should just – you know, get all that in line and, you know, use that money for, you know, trying people and whatever. It's not a good system at the moment. It's not, the end and the means are not matching, you know.
The thing that I see the worst effect of this is that the victims' families have no idea, regardless of what they've read before, they have no idea what they're going to experience in terms of the appeal process, in terms of how I'm not sure the term. Well, no, in terms of how an ordinary case, if it were to be life without parole or a life sentence with conditions of parole, would not be looked at with so much scrutiny as a death penalty case. And so you have these retrials where the family is dragged again. Interviewing authors,
that's true too.
They're dragged again. Yeah.
Yep. And sometimes they force these families, you know, they'll hold multiple trials.
Yeah.
And they sometimes now consolidate them. But, you know, the Golden State Killer, for example, they've consolidated, you know, all these murders. I've lost count how many there are, but I think there's something like 5 counties where these murders and rapes occurred up and down California, mm-hmm. and they've decided to try the case in Sacramento. I had another case that was a death penalty case of Wayne Adam Ford from my book Body Parts. Again, mm-hmm. 4 different counties, they consolidated them, and they tried the case in San Bernardino, which is a very conservative county where if the prosecutors put somebody up for the death penalty, the juries usually agree. Whereas where he turned himself in, you know, because he figured he was going to kill again and he knew that was wrong and he didn't want to keep doing it, was a very progressive county in Northern California where they don't send anybody to get the death penalty. And I don't know if he thought about it, but probably when he turned himself in, he wasn't even thinking about whether he'd get the death penalty or not. But,
no.
You know, even in California, it depends on what county you're tried in. There are certain counties that have a record of, you know, sending more people per capita, you know, to the death chamber, and as we've discussed, nobody's being executed. They're dying of suicide or they're dying of natural causes, and that's it. And it just costs a lot of money to house each individual inmate in a single cell, because that's what you have to do on death row. And they don't have room for all these people either.
But isn't it ridiculous to consider that you would say, listen, we're going to execute you. Here's your date. But if you have a medical condition,
they don't actually give them a
medical
date. They don't
okay,
give
but
a date.
You know the idea that you would be convicted and sentenced to death, but then somebody be worrying about your medical or mental health along the way to the journey to the death chamber, to some people would seem quite absurd.
Yeah, but in California, it took Skylar, I think, 7 years just for her appeal to be filed, period, let alone resolved. It's still pending. And here we are in 2019. She's been in prison for 10 years, and it still has not been rejected entirely. And so it's pretty well known, at least in California, that the appeal process takes a really long time, and then they fight that, and then once they exhaust the state system, then there's the federal system, and then they go through that.
Sure.
And, yeah, and we're paying for that. I mean, Skylar's, I think, considered indigent, so the taxpayers have to pay for that. And meanwhile, the families, I thought he was going to be killed, you know, executed. I didn't know it was going to take this long, you know.
Yeah.
But that's why in the John Gardner case, the DA said, look, the death penalty system is broken. Let's take the death penalty off the table and make a plea deal. And that way everybody gets justice because they didn't have enough evidence for the second murder. He led them to where he raped and killed Amber Dubois, but they were not able to find any independent corroborating evidence, and therefore they weren't going to be able to prosecute him on that murder, even though he took them to where they found her remains. And so the DA down here said, hey, made a deal, and said if he pleads guilty, life without parole, that Amber's family will get justice, and so will Chelsea King's, when they did have enough evidence to prosecute him for the death penalty on that, because she said, our system's broken. You know, who knows when he'd be executed, if at all, anyway, so what's the point? And so that, you know, if you have a DA who does that, that makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know...
You include...
Go ahead.
Sorry, you include one other thing that would be interesting to people following this case, is that the snitch scandal, 2014, and what has happened since. Just tell us about this snitch scandal.
I went back and forth on whether to include that because it's pretty complicated. But basically, I kind of wondered when I heard about this thing explode up in Orange County whether this case was going to get, you know, implicated and whether the prosecutor was going to get sucked into it, and eventually he did, except that because I live in San Diego County, it didn't get covered. And so when I sat down to do this update, I found some news articles that I hadn't seen before, and it turned out that basically, I'll try to simplify this if I can, but the public defender's office in Orange County was, they had a death penalty case, which is completely unrelated to this one, and they were looking into it and found evidence somehow that the sheriff's department, which runs the county jail, was basically running some kind of system off the books where they were setting up inmates to basically do interviews, get information from other inmates, and then the sheriff's department would get that information and give it to the DA's office, the prosecution, and the defense wouldn't know anything about it. So this guy put together a brief. It was like 550 pages full of evidence and examples of this, and it just blew up. And so the judge ultimately, you know, ended up taking the DA's office off the case, and the DA's office retaliated and papered him, essentially, you know, objecting to having him serve on a whole lot of their other cases. It just got really, really ugly with a lot of accusations going back and forth. Ultimately, it was pretty much shown that this was going on, and nobody really ever paid for it. And that's one of the things that Kamala Harris has as a presidential candidate. She was the attorney general for the state. It went up to her, and she just said, I'm going to let the local authorities handle it. And so she didn't get involved. Her predecessor still hasn't really, you know, done anything, and they kind of quietly closed whatever, quote-unquote, probe they were doing. There's still supposedly a federal probe into this whole thing. The DA was thrown out of office. There's a new DA in there who's trying to clean things up. And then this prosecutor on this case actually got pulled into it because he did, in fact, use a couple informants to talk to Skyler
right.
and wired him up and put him in a cell. And that's exactly what this whole informant scandal was alleging,
yeah.
this public defender. And apparently Matt Murphy was not allowed to talk about it for a long time. This was these records were sealed. I couldn't get access to it. I called the DA's office multiple times, could not get a response, could not get anything out of them. And then I ultimately found a news article that said that he was cleared by a judge of no wrongdoing. But, you know, I went through five trials on this case and another case for another book, I'll Take Care of You, with Matt Murphy as the prosecutor. And, you know, I didn't want to believe that he did anything wrong, but and there wasn't anything proven that he did wrong. But there was definitely some accusations hanging there for a while that seemed, you know, to be similar to what was alleged in the other cases. So I don't, you know, no, I guess you can't say that, you know, he personally had anything to do with it. It was a pre-existing system that was kind of set up within the sheriff's department, and they basically tried to blame specific people within the sheriff's department, and nobody really took accountability for it, and it was just a mess. And I don't know, hopefully it's not still going on, but basically what they were using inmates against each other and feeding it to, you know, get them favors, to get them some they were hoping for leniency on their own cases, right? And that's what snitches do. I mean, that's not something new.
Sure.
But in this case, when you're not telling the defense and you're doing a whole secret covert thing off the books, that ended up trickling down into this. And but ultimately, Matt Murphy was apparently cleared by a judge of any wrongdoing. So, and he's now since left the office and has gone into TV and a private practice. So
it's fortunate, because that is the kind of thing, if it were to be proved that he gave leniency to Danny Elias, jailhouse
right.
snitch, and especially
yeah.
under the conditions that you have reported, where they had the cell wired on behalf of these inmates that were trying
right.
to
right.
inform. So that's
well,
that's
the thing was,
you know,
though, at least in this case, that wasn't hidden. I mean, that did come out in court.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like they hid that from the defense.
Right.
But I think in the other case, that was the allegation, that they had hidden that from them.
So what is Skyler, what is her position today? What's her status today? What is she trying to do?
Well, I haven't been able to communicate with her since I went to go visit after the attorney shut me down. She won't respond to my letters anymore. I did get one of her other attorneys on the phone. She was very curt with me. She hung up on me. She said, I don't think it's in Skyler's best interest to communicate with her, with you, and I'll have her send you a letter to that effect, which I never got. But, you know, Skyler, as far as I know, I mean, I got the court petition for her. She's now legally female. She's legally changed her name. And so I'm basically just speculating at this point that she did that, not just because she really wants to say, hey, I'm female, but because she wants to get to a female prison. I mean, she told me that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that that would just bolster her request, because I've already been told by the prison spokespeople, if an inmate identifies as a woman and they're in a male prison, we have to take their request seriously. It's by a case-by-case basis, and we take it under advisement, and we you know, consider it. So there's not, like, any rule, any steadfast rule, like, if you request it, you get it. But I'm thinking that definitely must help her case legally, you know. because it's no longer based on genitalia. And unless and until she gets that operation. And again, I mean, there's one other thing I don't think I mentioned. There's another criteria. One of the criteria in the rules for this application process for this taxpayer subsidized surgery, and that is the elements of the crime. So I'm thinking that,
yeah,
number one, gender dysphoria, that's a medical condition. Okay, that would, and she definitely qualifies for it from that standpoint. However, if she's still quote unquote mentally incompetent, well then she can't give medical consent.
Right.
You know, in a conscious fashion to have the surgery, that is a criteria. She must be mentally competent to make her own medical decisions. And according to her attorney some years ago, she wasn't mentally competent to talk to me. Therefore, we can't have both ways, you know. You're either,
yeah,
mentally competent or you're not. And so I think I'm pretty sure that's why they wouldn't talk to me, because I clearly pointed out how they were trying to have it both ways. And then the other criteria, you know, if the motive in the murder is I want money to pay for gender confirmation surgery, that's an element of the crime. I would think they would take that into consideration, that why should they grant that if that's why they killed, why she killed people.
Exactly.
I would think that would matter. I wasn't able to get any answer. I did ask that, but they're like, you know, we don't know what our doctors would say. That's the answer I got. So
I think by the language, it sounded like a disqualifier in terms of the motive being related to being transgender, defenses of the individual.
I think, though, that it would still be a legal battle, because they would say, hey,
certainly,
under the Eighth Amendment, you're subjecting her to cruel and unusual punishment by forcing her to be subjected to this severe emotional distress caused by her penis. I mean, that would be their argument.
Yeah, incredible.
Which we don't understand, because we don't have that condition.
No.
But
no,
I'm not trying to kill myself. I'm not trying to mutilate myself, and that's their argument. Clearly, it must be bad enough for her to do that. It must be pretty bad.
It's a definitely an incredible twist to an already incredible story.
Yeah.
Dead Reckoning.
Can't make this stuff up.
No. I want to thank you very much, Caitlin, for coming on and talking about the extensively and revised and updated version of Dead Reckoning.
Well,
for those that
so
might
much.
Want to take a look at, thank you. For those that might want to take a look at other work, you know, tell us about her website page. I know this is a Wild Blue Press release. Tell us about where they might look at other work and Facebook page, website.
Wild Blue Press has this book in trade paperback and also as a Kindle. And you can get it on Amazon, or you can get it directly off the Wild Blue Press site, wildbluepress.com. I've got a website. I've got, if people want signed copies, they can contact me. I've got, this
great,
is, I've got 13 books. This is one of 13. I'm working on two more.
Wow.
If I could just talk briefly about one of them, that would be great.
Sure, absolutely.
The Rebecca Zahau case. I just, yesterday or today, actually, it was just announced in Publishers Marketplace. I have a deal with Kensington Citadel to do a trade paperback, which is bigger, you know, than those mass market paperbacks that they were doing before. The bigger paperback that looks more like a hardcover, but it's paperback. On this case of this young woman who was 32 years old, living with this older, very wealthy multimillionaire named Jonah Shacknai, her boyfriend, she was found hanging from an exterior balcony here in Coronado, California. So that's a small island here right off the coast of San Diego. The two harbors face each other, essentially. There's a lot of naval bases and military and retired military who live on that island, and wealthy people and people from Arizona where it's hot come to stay in the summer, which is where they're from. They spent the rest of the year in Scottsdale. And anyway, they'd been living together for a couple of years, and Jonah had a six-year-old son who Rebecca was very attached to and took care of, and Jonah had two ex-wives, and so that was the son with the second wife, and then he also had a son and a daughter with the first wife, and Rebecca did not get along so well with his older daughter, anyway, so there was a lot of drama, and basically what happened is Rebecca's 13-year-old sister came out to visit, and Jonah's son and daughter left to go visit their mother back in South Carolina, and Jonah went off to the gym, and Rebecca was downstairs in the bathroom, and her sister was upstairs in a bathroom, and suddenly Rebecca heard this crash and came out and found little six-year-old Max on the floor in the lobby area with a broken chandelier and a scooter, and the dog was barking, and there was a soccer ball. Anyway, he was on his back, and he wasn't breathing, and so they called 911, and basically he was severely injured, and anyway, 2 days later, Rebecca was found dead, hanging from this exterior balcony one morning by Jonah's brother, who came out from Memphis, Tennessee, to show support for, you know, the family was in the hospital mm-hmm. by the bedside of this boy. And he called 911 and said, "I got a girl hung herself in the guest house where he was staying, and she was in the main house." So right away, first words out of his mouth don't make sense compared yeah. to what actually he said happened. So anyway, it's a mystery, okay? So it looks pretty suspicious because she's naked. She's naked. She's got her hands tied behind her back. Her wow. feet are tied together. And she's got a T-shirt wrapped around her neck and in her mouth. So she's gagged oh. and bound, and she's naked, hanging outside by this, like, you know, jet ski rope, this orange boating kind of rope with these weird knots. So anyway, the Coronado police are used to dealing with bicycle theft. That's like their big crime on Coronado, so they aren't clearly capable of dealing with this. So they call in the sheriff's department. Sheriff's department comes out, and they do this whole investigation. And long story short, it took them, I don't know, some weeks. And they say, oh, it's a suicide. And Max, you know, ended up having fatal injuries and dying, at least being brain dead, a couple days after Rebecca was found dead. Mm-hmm. And the sheriff said that Rebecca was the only adult in the house and felt guilty and killed herself because she felt guilty about Max's death because she was so attached to him and felt so bad about what happened to him. And
wow.
Max had a tragic but accidental fall. So anyway, it just turned into this huge monumental controversy because Rebecca's family said there's no way she would commit suicide. There's no way she would commit suicide like that.
Sure.
It was murder. And the sheriff's department said, no, it's suicide. And so it's just been going on and on for years. And then finally there was a civil trial. Her family accused Jonah's ex-wife and her sister and his brother of conspiring to kill Rebecca, and then the attorney dismissed the two women and just left the brother. And when it went to trial last year, the jury found the brother responsible for her death. And
wow.
the sheriff was basically running for re-election and said, well, okay, fine, you know, it's suicide. And until his election opponent said, well, if I were elected, I'd immediately reopen the murder case. And so the sheriff said, okay, fine, we won't reopen the criminal case. We will review the court trial transcripts and review whatever theories came out. And then they waited until long after the election was over. He was reelected, and they basically said, no, it's still a suicide. So this has just been raging on and on, and the whole community of Coronado and everyone that I talk to always says, that's a murder. No, there's no way she would have done that
yeah.
to herself. It doesn't make any sense.
Sure.
The family
yeah.
still says it was murder. The sheriff still says it's suicide. There's been a bunch of documentaries on TV about it. But I'm basically just approaching it from a neutral standpoint, and I'm just seeing where the truth takes me and trying to look into the background of everybody, the context, who was doing what when, what was going on at the time with, you know, between all these parties. You know, what does the public not know that would help put all this into context and see if I can find out what really happened. And so that's, it's called Justice for Rebecca, at least tentatively that's what the title is.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating investigation.
It is. It's haunting, honestly. And the reason it's haunting, especially for me, is because my husband committed suicide and he hung himself. So that's part of the reason why the publisher gave me this deal, is because I am going to be looking at this case through the lens of my own experience, because I have a perspective that's pretty unique on this case.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what it's going to take.
That's it.
Yeah, that's what it's going to take for this book. Yes. Incredible. Thank you for sharing that preview
sure.
of this incredible book
coming
up, Justice for Rebecca. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about Dead Reckoning, the newly revised and updated version. You have a great evening, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you soon.
Great.
Great
Thanks
night.
So much, Dan. All right.
Thank
bye.
You, Caitlin.
Thank you, Caitlin.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.